My name's Michael Earle, and I'm a female alcoholic. And I feel just overwhelmingly nervous. So I'm going to tell a little joke for Miss Amanda. And for Donna H. She's not here, but this is a joke that I heard from her, and she got it at an Al-Anon conference. So, an Al-Anon really started it. And I love it because it's about the South and Southern women. You know, and I'm from California, and I moved here. I married my husband, and he was really born in Canada, but he came here when he was 2, so he's very Southern. He says, 5-5-5, and just very Southern. But when I moved here, we had, there were some women that just, to me, in my judgmental opinionated self, seemed very stuck up. They were from Old Money. And you can have as much money as anybody, but if it's new money, it doesn't count. I don't get it. You know, I don't get it. But anyway, so these two women are sitting on the porch of a big mansion with the big columns and everything, and they're drinking mint juleps. Some of you have heard this, but I hope a lot of you have. Drinking mint juleps and fanning themselves because it's very hot. And the one had just taken a trip to New York for 2 weeks. It was her vacation, and she came back, and she's telling her friend about a trip. And she said, "Did you know in New York City they have men who kiss men on the mouth?" "Oh, word. What do they call them?" "Well, they call them homosexuals. And did you know in New York City they have women who kiss women on the mouth?" "Oh, my God. What do they call them?" "Well, they call them lesbians. And did you know in New York City they have men who kiss women all over their private parts?" "Oh, my word, what do they call them?" When I caught my breath, I called them precious. I used to always call my husband precious, but after that joke, I mean, if I asked him to call him precious, he just anyway, so I'm supposed to share on step 12, and you know, I love all the steps. I just love all the steps. They complement each other, they work for each other. I've heard a lot of things. You know, Bill had a lot of quirks. You know, a lot of quirks. And I heard that that each step had a principle behind it. I just haven't read that in the book. You know, Bill talks about principles. He did not like to use the same word twice. He liked to switch up words, so character defects and shortcomings are the same thing. He just didn't want to use the same word twice. And he calls the steps principles, tools, proposals, spiritual principles, spiritual proposals, spiritual tools, anything he can think of to just switch up the words. All those things you hear about honesty and selfishness, if they are embodied in the 12 steps. But in the book, when he's talking about principles, he's talking about the steps. So the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics. What message are we carrying to the alcoholic? We're carrying the message that we've had a spiritual awakening as a result of those steps. And then, of course, it says, and we try to practice these principles in all of our affairs. And so that means we practice these steps in all of our affairs. And there's not anything that goes on in my life that I can't apply the steps to. You know, I don't have to put all those words that are embodied in the steps. I just sometimes have to start all over on step one on a particular problem. I'm a big person for 6 and 7 because I had a lot of major character defects when I got here. Somebody said to me, "Don't share about the bad." You know, I'm with a bunch of women, and if I can't share with you, that was a character defect that almost killed me these last 2 years. I mean, who can I share it with? I can share it with my sponsor, but everybody knows me. When you have 37 years, you don't get much time with your sponsor. But it's something that I had to apply the steps on. You know, when I came in down to like Phenomenal, I had 6 months of sobriety. I was very obese, and that's what I did. I applied 6 and 7 on my weight, and I was a size 6 for 15 years in California. I love Cynthia. I love her. Because I've had such a rough, the last 20 years has been really difficult. You have ups and downs. I've had more downs than most people. And Cindy, somebody who's had worse than me. Oh, and I was so excited. I know that sounds terrible, but sometimes you feel like, what's wrong with me? You know, what's wrong with me? Polly doesn't have any physical issues. She is like a 16-year-old as far as I'm concerned. I'm having 3 back surgeries, 2 knee replacements, 3 foot surgeries. My daughter's bedridden. I take care of a 52-year-old bedridden daughter who's incontinent. And she was supposed to die 5 years ago. I've never mentioned it from the podium until she was in hospice. And when I talked about it from the podium, everybody started praying for her. And her liver enzymes improved enough to take her off of hospice. So, now, I get to do it all by myself. You know, and it's been a tough year. And while we're waiting for my husband, my daughter's dying, my husband's son died in a tragic accident. And he was a single father, and he had a 15-year-old and an 18-year-old. So we had all of that, you know, we're dealing with my... We've had a lot of things. And then my husband. This is what I love about being judgmental. And, you know, Bill says we have to make judgments. We have to judge what we want to be like and what we don't want to be like. But when we use judgmentalness as, you know, character assassination, it's not good. And my husband at first, when I started having all these physical problems, really judged me. You know, I've never known somebody who's had so many problems, been to the hospital so many times, had so many facts. And, okay. And so a couple of years after that, he had really big feet. He's really tall. He fell several times, so he shattered one shoulder, had to have the shoulder replaced, shattered the other shoulder, shattered both wrists. These are all different falls. Broke both of his thumbs. Then he had a compound fracture in his elbow. I just looked at him and I said, "I'm so sorry, but that's what happens when you judge other people." And that's what happened to me, as far as I'm concerned, with my weight. Because in California, I was a size 6 for 15 years. And I hooked up with a group that were direct sponsees of Dr. Bob. And that's how I went through the steps. And they really put a lot into step 6. And there were only 6 steps back then. But at the moral inventory, which was oral, they took the actions of going over character defects at great length because they believed that you might drink over some of these character defects. They said the prayer to have those defects removed, and then they made that list of amends to me. Bill wanted to stretch those steps into 12 for spiritual reasons. And I've heard many people say it was for the 12 apostles. I'm so, I go, which step was Judas? I don't know what's wrong with me. I just got to find an issue with everything. But something happened to me, and this is just saying. A couple years ago, I was thinking about Bill's sobriety date. Everybody knows Bob's sobriety date. It's the date of Alcoholics Anonymous anniversary. And everybody knows that Bill was about 6 months sober. But I've never heard people talk about his sobriety date. And so I asked a lot of people, and nobody really knew what his sobriety date was. So I had to go through a lot of books, a lot of literature, and I finally found his sobriety date. His last drink, and that's when they celebrate their anniversary, was the day of their last drink. Not the first day of sobriety, the day of their last drink. So his last drink was December the 11th. So that means the first day of sobriety was 12-12. And I just thought that was, just saying. Anyway, I'm just going to kind of go through the steps and how they applied to me. You know, when I came into this program, I'd already taken the first three steps. And I didn't even know what the first three steps were. But I knew I was powerless over alcohol. My life had never, ever been manageable. I come from, I guess you could call it a tragic background. You know, I didn't know it was a tragic background at that time, but I can certainly see it now. And I always wanted to say, in my mom's defense, I want to tell you a little bit about her background, because as bad as my childhood was, my mom's was worse. And this program gave me the ability to have a very loving relationship with my mom, even though she couldn't quit drinking. I lost my mom 12 years ago. She died of lung cancer, and I had the opportunity to practice love and service at home. We had hospice come in, and my mom actually got to die with a little bit of dignity. I had the ability to get in bed with my mom, hold her all night, and just love her unconditionally. And I had to watch her drink on top of morphine up until the day she could no longer swallow. And it's probably one of the hardest things that I've done. But one thing I learned about this, from this experience, is that my whole life growing up, I was so focused on the things I hated about my mom, the things I didn't want to be like, that I missed all of her wonderful qualities. My mom had a lot of wonderful qualities, and I really miss her a lot today. And my mom came from an alcoholic background, and when she was 13, her mother was murdered in a drunken brawl. A drunk slit my grandmother's throat. So that left my mom out on the streets at the age of 13 trying to raise herself, because her father was in what you call a chain gang. At the age of 14, she had a first baby, which she gave up for adoption, and then she had me. And she did everything in her power to keep me. She later met a man, got married, had three boys. We all moved to California. That marriage soon ended in the divorce, and my stepdad moved back to Colorado. So that left my mom out in California trying to raise four little kids. We were raised on welfare. We were raised in extreme, extreme poverty, always having lights, gas, telephones turned off, always being evicted, even having to sleep in cars. And then I had to deal with my mom's alcoholism, I had to deal with her prostitution, and I had to deal with all of her suicide attempts. When I was 12, my mom got pregnant again, and this time she sent my three brothers to live with their real dad in Colorado. Now, my three brothers were my best friends. When you sleep in cars, you're always being evicted, you don't have an opportunity to make friends. So my brothers were my friends. So I feel like at the age of 12, I had all these feelings that I later brought with me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and those feelings were low self-worth, low self-esteem, not equal to, and just not good enough. And that's a direct result of all that poverty. The drunken psychiatrist, which I hadn't mentioned yet, pointed out to me that I had issues of abandonment. You know, I never knew my real dad, my stepdad went away, my three brothers went away, my mom's always trying to kill herself. And because of some other childhood experiences, I would say I'm a fear-based person. I've always been afraid of people, places, and things. And so I really like to talk about fear, and I'm just going to try and save that for another step. But my mom really wanted to be sober. I really wanted to be sober. And Mari, that's the first time I've heard you mention not drinking till 25. Yesterday. Because that's my story too. I didn't want to be like my mom. I never took a drink until I was 25 years old. Just trying to be not like her. And everything she did, all that disgusting stuff, I did all that stuff sober before I took a drink. You know, when I crawled through these doors, I had a formal ninth grade education. I didn't know how to work other than welfare. I was reduced to prostitution, and I was a thief. And all of that was before I took that first drink at age 25. Anyway, my mom really wanted to be sober, and I really wanted to be sober. And we both tried to recover from this disease through the psychiatric effort, different times, but we went to the same psychiatrist. Of course, the result was nil. But the good news is, today that psychiatrist is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through the religious effort, different times in different congregations, but the result was the same. And believe it or not, today that minister that counseled me is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to joke around and say, I think we drove these two men to drink. But the truth is, and this is the truth, my mom slept with the psychiatrist and I slept with the minister. Spirituality by injection. I need my fan now. I've only said that once in 25 years of speaking. I've only said that once. And that's what the paper had to pull out of the talk and list within all my talks. And I've never said that except for one time. But I just had to say it today. I'm just feeling on behind it. Anyway, that psychiatrist, that minister, and myself are perfect examples that AA works when other things fail. So when I was 12, my mom got pregnant again, and she sent my three brothers to live with their real dad. I cannot tell you the abandonment I felt. I've always had these huge issues of abandonment. And those are some of the things that I dealt with, you know, in 6 and 7, and the fear issue. And I'm going to go ahead and talk about the fear at this point, I think, because it's another thing that controlled my life. And, oh, also regarding step 6, my sponsor said, what do you think your biggest character defect is? And I said, stealing? And she said, no, not even close. And I went, prostitution? And she said, no. And I said, okay, what's my biggest character defect? She said, self-pity. And I couldn't believe it. I said, well, I think my self-pity is justified. Look at my childhood. And she said, Michael, alcoholics cannot afford justified self-pity. That's poor me, poor me. Pour me another drink. And I can tell you, truly, self-pity's been totally removed, and it's been replaced with overwhelming gratitude. Even when I was going through those trials and low spots over the last 20 years, I still had all this gratitude that I did not have to take a drink over it, and that my sobriety was more important today than it was when I first walked into these doors, because I have so much more to lose. And people do go through ups and downs. It's just the way it is. And I'm so glad that I had a sponsor that was transparent, that let me see her good and her bad. Because there are lines of sponsorship where, I mean, it's almost like a written rule. You don't share the bad stuff with your sponsees, just your sponsor. I mean, if Polly hadn't shared some of this stuff with me, I think I would have always thought, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And the greatest thing she shared with me was menopause. Oh, my God, you would not have known Polly when she was going through menopause. But, I mean, some people actually get suicidal over it. It's just so dramatic. But my watching her go through it and get on the other side when my turn came, I just knew I was going to get on the other side. And that menopause took me into a depression I'd never experienced. I don't have feelings of depression. I'll have panic attacks and anxiety. Polly suffered terrible depression. But my menopause took me to that dark hole they talk about. And today I'm very grateful for it. I feel like I'm a better sponsor today because now I understand how dark it is in that deep, dark hole. And it just seems like you're never going to pull your way out of it. Anyway, so I'd say I'm a fear-based person. I've always been afraid of people, places, and things. And the two very important things I learned when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, first, I learned that feelings are not facts. All those things I used to think about myself are not the truth. And best of all, I learned how to walk through fear. And I learned that every time I walk through fear, I'm actually exercising faith. And this last 25 years, I've walked through one of my biggest fears, two of my biggest fears. One of them was getting up at the podium and sharing my story. I could not get up at the podium and read how it works with 4 years of sobriety. I could not do it. I could barely read when I got here. And then getting on airplanes. Oh, my God. Driving on a freeway. My world got real, real small. I would have a panic attack trying to just drive out of the city of Long Beach, and I'd have to turn around and go back. And my sponsor at that time helped me with that one by having me get on the freeway and get off on the first exit. Next day, I get on the freeway, get off on the second exit, and then get on the third exit. And that's how I eventually got where I could leave the city of Long Beach. And I'm 10 years sober going through this stuff. But when it came to flying, I have turned down some great opportunities because I just was not going to get on a plane. And there's probably a reason for it. You know, in our inventory, it tells us, you know, what is our fear and why do we have it? I can almost put a reason why I have every fear I have. And I had a friend that died in the Canary Island crashes. I don't know if any of you remember that years ago. And I don't know if that's where my fear started or not. But I know since then I've never been able to get on an airplane until I came to having to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was just the most terrifying thing. I had a woman that was going to take me to the airport and meet me on the plane. And an emergency happened and she had to just drop me off at 6 o'clock in the morning in Los Angeles. I'm at LAX in the ticket area. And I know I'm not going to get on that plane. I know I cannot get on that plane. And the thought of not keeping an AA commitment, I think I would have rather died, but not in a plane crash. I would rather die than not keep my commitment, you know. And so I stood there, and I started to have one of those terrible panic attacks. I mean, where I don't know if you've had them, but you literally can't breathe, and my body shakes so bad, and my knees go out from under me. You know, I collapse, and I fell back into a chair, and I was able to start crying, which is a good thing for me, because then I stopped panicking. I started crying, and I had a spiritual experience at that moment. I had an inner voice talk to me, and it was loud, and it was clear, and it wasn't very kind. It didn't say, oh, baby, no. It said, Michael, why don't you get out of yourself and try and help somebody? I was startled. You know, I just went, what? I'm looking around and I'm going, this isn't an AA meeting. And then I noticed at the escalator, you have to take escalators up to the planes, there were some little old ladies like I am today, struggling with their bags. And so I just jumped over, ran over there, and started helping them up the escalator with their bags. And that worked so well for me that every time I had to fly, I'd report at the escalator like I worked there. And I carried pen and paper with me. And when we were in turbulence where the stewardess can't even get up, you know, everybody has to sit in place. So you can't run down the aisle and say, let me help somebody. And so what I do is I pull out pen and paper and I start writing out the third step prayer and putting somebody else in it. Whether they're dealing with finances, love, sobriety, whatever they're dealing with, health issues, I'll just say, God, I offer Amanda to be, to build with her and do with her as thou wilt. And so when we land, I have pages and pages of the third step prayer. But you can see, we've always landed. So, it's a tool I still use. And what I learned is I'm not afraid of flying. I'm afraid of crashing. And my sponsor told me I'd better be clear what my fear was when I was asking God to remove it. I hear a lot of things in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that are not in the Big Book, and they can confuse newcomers. And one thing I used to hear all the time is you could not have fear and faith at the same time. That if you had fear, you didn't have any faith. And I couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong in my program because I worked these steps as hard as I could work these steps. I've had spiritual experiences, many of them. But I still had all this overwhelming fear. And this one guru in our area who passed out a coin that says fear on one side, faith on the other side. I went up to him and I said, what am I doing wrong in my program? Why do I still have all this fear? And he looked at me in the most smug, arrogant way, and he says, well, sounds to me like you haven't taken a thorough third step. Today I know I have taken a thorough third step. I mean, for me, a thorough third step is a process. It's not just saying a prayer. The process for me to do a thorough third step is taking those actions of 4 through 9. When I've done those actions, I consider my third step thorough. And I might have to do it again over different defects. There's a lot of things where I might have to apply the third step prayer and take a set of actions. But anyway, I was wanting to tell on him. I was very upset with him. And so I went over to one of these old timers that was very instrumental in my sobriety. And I was crying on his shoulder. Said that I'm taking a thorough third step because I'm afraid. And basically what Bill told me is he said, Mike, nowhere in the Big Book does it say you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. And he took me to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and he pointed out a page to me under the fear inventory. What a coincidence. And that sentence says, all men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. And then he pointed out to me, you don't need courage unless you're afraid. Oh, my God. It's like, oh, my God. And then he took me to that last paragraph. And, well, he took me to the prayer where it says, God, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. I'm always directed to work with another person, whether they're in the program or out of the program. But I'm always directed to help somebody. And when I can help somebody, I can get out of myself. And that fear just seems to dissipate. And then that last sentence in that paragraph says, at once we commence to outgrow fear. It does not say at once we outgrow fear. It says we commence to outgrow fear. So I'm 37 years sober, and I'm still commencing. And that's okay, because in steps 10 and 11, it says we're to continue watching for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. So it's not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. You know, when you really read the book and understand it, it's a big relief for some of the things that I was dealing with, that it should continue with a lifetime. So some of us might have to just deal with some of these things, you know, for our whole, you know, our whole life, and just pull out the tools and use them. But I know for me the most important thing about fear is I have to walk through it. And every time I walk through it, I have this faith that I knew was there all along. You know, it's like I knew this plane was going to land. So, but walking through fear is exercising faith. Step 2 came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I had no problem with the word sanity. I mean, I knew I had a problem with restore because I've never been sane. I mean, there's nothing sane about my childhood, my life. There's never been what I can measure sanity to. So I had a problem with the word restore. So I just have to give it to the spiritual world and know in the spirit world I'm perfect and maybe he'll restore me to something that I don't know. But I had a huge spiritual experience before I ever got to this program. And this was equivalent to the one that Bill had in Bill's story. You know, in the big book, it says, as a result of a spiritual awakening, you'll have a change in psyche, a change in attitude. It says you'll have this huge emotional displacement and rearrangement. And this spiritual experience I had was not enough for me to achieve that. And I believe it's because I did not have a plan of action to go with it. But it was enough for me to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So what I did is I sought out a very specific church. I've never shared this experience with anybody. I just tell them I had this huge experience. But for some reason, I'm going to share it with you. I was being evicted from my apartment. I didn't have any money. I didn't know how I was going to feed my daughter. And I threw myself across the bed, and I was crying. And this is a very large room. And across the room was a bookshelf. And there was a book in that bookshelf, and it literally seemed to me to come out of the bookshelf right at me. And on the binding of the book, it said, change your life through prayer. And it just came to my hand. I don't know where the book came from. Well, I do know where the book came from, but it wasn't my book. It was my mom's book. At one time when she tried to recover in church, said, change your life through prayer. So I opened it, and the first thing I read in that book, it said, this book has come to you as a miracle, so don't let it leave until you receive the gift. So I started reading it, and I couldn't read very well, and things in it made me mad, and I threw it, and I just had this relationship with this book that was bittersweet, you know. But I finally got through the book, and it was very metaphysical and positive thinking and all that kind of stuff, like think your way into right actions. But I sought out a specific church, and I counseled with this minister, and I told him all about my spiritual experience, and I shared with him all my character defects and all my shortcomings. And he assured me if I got really active in this church and I read all these inspirational books and I did all this positive thinking, that I could be everything that I ever wanted to be. After I got sober in this program, I heard a speaker at the podium say, if you're an alcoholic, you cannot think your way into right actions. He said, if you're an alcoholic, you have to act your way into right thinking. And I am absolute proof of that. I got really active in that church. I became the secretary of that church, so my job was to handle the money. So the only thing that resulted in that church is I ended up having a tour fair with the minister, and I stole the church money. And I just had a spiritual experience, you know, and so, I mean, that's really tough to have this spiritual experience, turn to God for help, seduce his minister, and rip off his church. So I truly know the feeling of hopelessness I talk about in the big book. I'm going to share two stories with you while I'm on the subject of the minister. Maybe I'll share one. For me, the most important step is step 9. So I probably should choose these in order. But I do want to share this one thing with you. I was 4 years sober. My daughter was 3 years sober. She was leaving an AA dance. She got sober when she was 15. At the age of 18, she was leaving an AA dance. A man with a gun walked up to her and her girlfriend in the parking lot and forced these two girls in the car at gunpoint. And he kidnapped them. He beat the one girl unconscious and brutally raped my daughter for over 2 hours. It's the things that happened to her I didn't know could happen. As bad as my childhood was, I mean, she couldn't have children after this experience. And it took her 2 years to remember she did say a quiet prayer to live. And when he, thank God he was drinking, he had a bottle of alcohol in his pocket, he drank throughout the whole ordeal, and he became very drunk, which is a good thing. He was forced into the trunk of the car, she was stark naked, and somehow she got the courage to make some kind of an effort to save her own life. He had this gun on her the whole time, and she was very submissive. But when it came to getting into the trunk, she just all of a sudden turned around and hit him in the face with her elbow. And he fell down, the gun slid under the car, and she ran around ran away naked, but she got away. And later he took off with the car with the other girl. He beat the one girl unconscious and later took off with her still in the car, rolled her out in the street, and so both girls survived. But the road of recovery was real hard, and it was real long. But my daughter and I both felt absolutely betrayed. How could God let something like this happen to us? We were both sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had this man come up to me, and he said, at this one conference I talked at, he said, "You talk like it happened to you." I said, "Well, obviously you're not a mother." I mean, that's the most horrible thing, you know, and to have your daughter wake up every night with night terrors for 2 years and not leave the house and all the things that I went through with her, you know, just, but, I don't even know where I was going with that. Who did I get that from? Pat. Pat came up to me. Isn't Pat the one that had that the other night, Friday night? Just a little brain fart. Thanks, Pat. Anyway, so she struggled with her sobriety. She turned her back on God. I'll tell you, first of all, the hardest sentence for us to deal with was the sentence in the Big Book, and one of the speakers talked about it. And in the third edition, it's 449. In the third edition, it's 417. It's Dr. Paul's story, talks about acceptance. Love the part on acceptance. But that one sentence says, absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. Clancy says, alcoholism is a disease of perception. I'm still an alcoholic. I get my disease of perception because I perceive that to mean that nothing in God's world happens by mistake, then that has to be an act of God. I really thought it had to be an act of God, and I wanted to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to leave God. And thank God for that man, Bill Honeycutt. He just took me by the hand, and he said, "Michael, you know, God is good, and good is God. And if it's not good, it's not of God." He said, "Man has free will." That man was acting on his free will, and your daughter was just a victim. He said, "If man didn't have free will, we wouldn't all be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd all be perfect people." And when he told me that, I had a huge spiritual release. And I knew for me, he was telling me the truth. So I came to terms with my God again, but I still had trouble with that sentence in the Big Book, which I'll share about later. So my daughter, in and out of the program, I managed to stay sober. I had to seek God at a new level. And my daughter just turned her back on God, in and out, in and out, in and out. And she'd get a sponsor that would say, "You have to forgive your perpetrator." She'd try and forgive, she'd get drunk. Get another sponsor, "Have to forgive your perpetrator." She'd try, she'd get drunk. All they were doing is rehashing it. And rehashing it and just bringing it up. She finally got a sponsor that said, "Let's just put that on the back burner, get you through your steps, and get you working with other women." And that's how my daughter finally got sober. But it was my second time to ever give an AA talk. The first time was very depressing. It was just like, oh, God. And Polly really thought I had some recovery to share, because what I did in the first 10 years was pretty miraculous. But she really thought I had recovery to share. She was always trying to get me to speak. One day she had pneumonia or something, and she was just speaking in a little place in Long Beach, and she talked me into talking for her. I was so pressed when I went home. I said, "God, if this is what you want me to do in this program, you're going to have to lighten up my story, or I'm going to kill myself." And so the next time I talked, my daughter heard I was talking, and she brought some of her program girlfriends over to my house. We sat down and we had coffee. My daughter proceeded to tell her girlfriends my drink log. And for some reason, it was a little funnier coming out of her mouth than out of my head. And of course, she's telling these girls about the minister. She's telling them that I'm dragging her off to church every day. She's learning things like the Ten Commandments, the Golden Rule, constantly preaching all this religious stuff to her. She comes home from school at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She opens the bedroom door, and they're naked in bed with her mom, who's the married minister of the church. And when she first said this, I felt appropriate feelings. I felt shame. I felt guilt and embarrassment. But I felt this utter compassion for my daughter. And I just looked at her in the most sympathetic way. I said, God, honey, that had to be a terrible shock. I used to cry at this part. Oh, my God. My daughter looked at me and she said, no, Mom, I don't know what shocked me the most, seeing that minister naked or seeing his artificial leg on the floor. Up until that time, I forgot he had an artificial leg. It was a big leg. But trust me, in ways that were important, he wasn't disabled. That are funny in my story, but every one of them my daughter gave me that night, telling her girlfriends about my drug luck. So, anyway, so step two, I really love the spiritual appendix in the back of the book where it talks about, you know, a spiritual awakening of the educational variety and spiritual awakenings of the thunderbolt lightning. I've had both spiritual experiences, and I know the thunderbolt lightning was not enough for me to get sober. And being in church was not enough for me to get sober. I always felt different. I didn't feel as good as any of those people. But when it came to taking those first three steps, when I was finally done and I couldn't do it another day, I was laying on my front room floor, I'm laying on my front room floor naked in a puddle of fluid. I don't know what the fluid was. Took the first three steps, and I didn't even know what the first three steps were. But I knew I was powerless over alcohol. My life had never, ever been manageable. And I already believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I just knew he wouldn't because of what I'd done to the church. And this was my way of turning my will and life over to the care of God. So I just got on my knees and I said, God, I don't care how you do it, but please just get me sober. And I managed to get to a telephone. I called a prayer line that was affiliated with the church I was in, and I asked them to pray for me because in my mind I thought if God wouldn't listen to my prayers because of what I've done to the church, maybe he would listen to their prayers. And they prayed for me for 30 days, and in 30 days, I was sober. And I am so ever grateful that I said, I don't care how you do it. Because the one thing I would never have done is come to AA. My mom was in and out of AA, and she proved to me it didn't work. Once she got a year of sobriety, she celebrated by having two drinks. She asked me to go with her, let's go celebrate. I haven't had a drink. So, I mean, that's what I thought about Alcoholics Anonymous. Not only that, she ran around with some really sleazy AA men. They're sleazy AA women, too. Usually people who come to these functions, you know, are serious about the program. But people sitting in the rooms at meetings, some of them are just there to get the heat off. They don't care about your anonymity. But I am not going to put my stuff out there in a meeting. I'm going to carry the message in the meeting and carry the message to my sponsor. And then I get to a big thing like this, and I put it on. Yeah. It's on tape. It goes around the world. Oh, God. My life's an open book. I want to tell you a little bit about my drinking, you know, how bad it was. I'm an alcoholic woman that drinks vodka so much down so fast that I stop breathing. I have to be rushed to the hospital and brought back to life. But I can sit there and hear somebody talk about a blackout. I've never had a blackout, so I must not be alcoholic. I just drink till I die. But that's not a blackout. And I get to remember the stuff I did. And that's really painful. I wish I was a blackout drinker. You know, some of the things that my daughter reminded me of that night when she came over for coffee was, after I had this thing with vodka and I almost died that night, the next day I was trying really hard not to drink. So I finally started listening to my daughter. She would tell me on a daily basis, she would say, "Mom, it's the alcohol. And if you wouldn't drink, you wouldn't do those things." She said, "Just smoke pot." So this is my only experience smoking pot. But I'm trying really hard not to drink. I don't have any friends of my own, so I smoke this pot with my daughter and her friends. And afterwards, we're walking down the street, and I have on these tight jeans, and I have my hands shoved down in my pockets. I don't know if I tripped over a crack or tripped over my foot, but I tripped. And I started to go down. Now, I don't know if any of you have been on pot, but I have to tell you, for me, it was different. I mean, I had the feeling that I was in slow motion. I had the sensation that the cement was coming up at my face. And what I remember the most is I tried so hard and I couldn't get my hands out of my pockets. So you've got a picture of a grown woman laying there with her face smashed with cement, her hands are still sticking out of her pockets. And all those gang members, she ran with the gang, all those gang members were laughing hysterically. They were absolutely hysterical. I wasn't laughing, but I could hear their laughing. And as I heard that laughter, I had that moment of clarity. I knew right then and there, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that pot was not the answer. And I went right back to my drinking. And I drank at the same pace for a while longer. Another experience I remember around that period of time is I started seeing evil spirits. I was in an apartment. I'm being evicted from my gas telephone. Had all been turned off for a long time. And I kept my drapes closed so the landlord wouldn't know I was home because he was trying to serve me an eviction notice. So my apartment's dark. It's always dark. It's so dark that now I'm seeing evil spirits. And these evil spirits would do things to me, like follow me around the house. And then I, in turn, would do things like crawl out of the house on my hands and knees, butt naked, across the street to my daughter's junior high school, and warn my daughter and her friends not to come home. The house is possessed with evil spirits. Thank God it was the back of the school and not the front of the school. And these gang members that were really rough and tough, they just felt sorry for my daughter, I guess, because they'd throw something over me, take me back home, and lock me in my own apartment. So, those are the things I get to remember, you know, and they're very unpleasant, you know, very unpleasant to remember them. And the only time I ever talk about them is if I'm going to share, because I want you to know I'm a real alcoholic. Even though I've never had a blackout, I am a real alcoholic. So I'm 6 months sober. Oh, I'll tell you how I got sober. After I did that third step prayer, I mean, prayed for God to get me sober. I don't care how you do it, just get me sober. I was trying really hard not to drink, and I started going through delirium tremens. I didn't know what to do with myself, so I went over to my mom's. Why my mom? I don't know. She's drinking. But she's trying really hard not to drink that night. I'm trying really hard not to drink that night. And she was very compassionate about what I was doing. So I'm over at her house, and the mayor of Signal Hill was driving past her apartment. And he knew her from when she was in AA. So he stopped and tried to talk her into going to a meeting, and she didn't want to go. She didn't want anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. So he started working on me, and I was just in a place that I would have done anything. Anything. I just didn't want to drink, and I felt like I was going to die. And so I went to the meeting with him, and he pulled up into the church parking lot, and he and another old-timer made me wait there. They ran across the street, and they bought two beers. They came back, and they made me drink them. I remember thinking, oh, maybe AA's not so bad. But it did what they wanted it to do. It stopped the delirium tremens, so I could at least hear something that was going on in the meeting. And I just heard what I needed to hear, because I might not have stayed if it had been another meeting. But this girl shared something I've never heard since. She shared that she didn't drink till later on in life. But she practiced her disease of alcoholism way before she ever took that first drink, and she did it in the form of compulsive overeating and amphetamine abuse. And that's my story, too. But the one thing she said, and this is the real reason why I stayed, she said, growing up, some kids wanted to be doctors, some kids wanted to be lawyers, and all she ever wanted to do when she grew up was not to be an alcoholic like her mom. And I just started to cry, and I cried throughout the rest of the meeting, and I just couldn't stop. It just poured out of me. And then the next day, that girl picked me up and took me to a Sunday morning meeting, and the delirium tremens started again, and I was so physically sick, I could not stay. And there's a woman who had a story in the Big Book. Her name was Monica, and her story was the third edition. It's called Any Day is Wash Day. And she gave me a ride home, and she shared a lot with me. She drank again, though. Her story is not in the Big Book now, in the fourth edition, because she drank again. And that was a powerful lesson for me to learn from, watching, you know, the progression of what she was doing to walk out of the program. So for a whole week, I could not leave the house. I was very sick, but I didn't drink. I came back, and I wanted to know what I looked like. I was huge. I was very obese. I had, my front teeth were worn up to the gum line, so it looked like I had no front teeth. I had all this wild bleach blonde hair, because I'd try and bleach my hair and I'd fall asleep. So you smash it into your skull, so you've got a few bald spots. And then the last 2 months I didn't try at all, so I've got bald spots, 2 inches of black roots, and then this orangish hair going all over. It's in style today, but it wasn't in style when I came in. I wore this big purple serape to cover my body in hopes that you wouldn't see me. I had no lights, telephone, gas, nothing. So I was a woman who didn't bathe. And that's what walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I finally went back after that week, they gave me a coffee commitment right away. I can't imagine giving somebody that looked like that a coffee commitment. Doesn't bathe, filthy, dirty, sirupy. But they did. I'm telling you, that's the best job I ever had. And they come in to me every Saturday and they lie to me and they tell me that's the best coffee they ever had. I've never made coffee. I don't know. I'm supposed to make coffee, so I don't know what they got. But I had too much pride to ever ask for a ride to a meeting. So I'd always take buses or I'd walk, but they always gave me a ride home. And I just started to grow from that point. I was so willing to do whatever I needed to do to get sober. Unfortunately, at that time when I came in, everybody was trying to do the steps out of 12 and 12. And, you know, the 12 and 12 was really written for the traditions. Bill wrote the traditions. They were so afraid no one would buy the book for the traditions that he added the steps. So on people who think it was supposed to replace the Big Book, sometimes you have to know the history of this program to understand why things are like they are. And then other people thought I needed to wait a year before I started on my steps. I just knew I was going to die. I just knew I had to do something. Not knowing what to do, I just grabbed the book and I did inventory, but the person I resented the most was myself. That doing that work was enough to keep me sober. And everything was, I'm resentful at myself, and it was about all the people I stole from, all the lies I've done, all the rotten mother I was, all the promiscuity, all that stuff. I got all those columns down. And I don't know who I read it to. I read it to somebody. And it gave me enough room to stay sober. And then this girl and I, who were both really wanted to, for some reason, we intuitively knew it was in this book. We knew it. And we heard about this group that came down from Dr. Bob's. They were sponsors of Dr. Bob's. And they'd take people through the steps. You meet with them 1 week. They give you the overall history, the God shots, and steps 1, 2, and 3 out of the Big Book in a formal way, and send you home to do your inventory. You come back, and then you do 5, 6, 7, and 8. And we had to drive a long ways to get over there, but we did. And we did everything they asked us to do. And then after we completed step 8, these were old mimeograph sheets, you know, those mimeograph machines. Everything they did with me, on these sheets of paper they handed to me, and they said, now go do it with another person. And that's when my life really changed. I had a way to take people through. I didn't have that much sobriety, but I had a way to take people through the steps because they taught me, and people were eager to have it. And they said I could change it and add to it and do whatever I needed to do to it, things that work for me, you know, make it my step work. And that was really the beginning of my working with others. And I know there's lots of ways to do service, but my niche, I feel, is taking people through steps. I have a meeting in my house on Wednesday nights. I've had it there now for over 20 years, and it's the soldiers from all over the world, mostly all over the United States, but there's other countries too, that are in treatment. And when I moved to Augusta, I came from a meeting of 300 people. I came from good sobriety. My home group's 10 people, and I'm the only woman. And the book says we're going to create the fellowship we crave. And so I started taking this first step meeting to this treatment center at the hospital, a military hospital. And they were saying crazy things like an inventory was their fourth step, confronting their parents as men. So I asked the counselors if I could just have them come over to my house on Wednesday nights for barbecue and book study. And so that's what we did. And we used to have to go pick them up and bring them over, and it would be like a 3 or 4 hour deal. But it was what I needed. I needed to be around newcomers. And we had a huge spiritual experience, one of the newcomers here. I had a way I did it. I, first of all, I'd give them the history I had for 4 weeks. I'd give them the overall history. I'd take them through steps 1, 2, and 3, show them how to do an inventory, and hope they get a sponsor wherever they're going. And it was wonderful, and it worked really well. And because of traveling, I could connect them with a lot of people. But one night we were on step 2, and I had just had back surgery. I've got staples up my back. I have blood loss, running a fever. And I told my husband, I don't think I can meet with the soldiers tonight, because he would fix the food and I would do the step work with them. And anyway, I kept hearing my sponsor's voice. You can be sick in the meeting as well as you can be sick in bed. You're going to feel like crap, so you might as well feel like crap if your butt planted in the meeting. And I just over and over saw. I decided I would suit up and show up. And when we were on step 2, the word God came up. This man sitting right next to me, he jumped up, he started cussing about God, screaming profanities. I could feel spit on my face from him being so angry. And when I first told you this story, I would tell you, my first thought was, oh my God, I don't know what to say or do, but that was my first thought. My first thought was, I can't believe I got out of bed for this crap. That was my first thought. Takes me a while to get real honest. But anyway, so the other soldiers got him down, pushed him down, and the last thing he said when they were sitting him down, they said, if there's a God, it's going to take a burning bush to prove it to me. And I knew I was thinking, gee, I'm not a burning bushes. But his name was Lee, and that reminded me of a story of another man named Lee from Gulf Shores, Alabama, that had spiritual experience during one of my talks. Had nothing to do with me. It had everything to do with him, sitting where he was sitting. You'd have to hear the whole story, but it's too long to tell. But it took him 2 years to write me this letter about the spiritual experience. So anyway, I was sharing that story with all these soldiers about this man named Lee that had spiritual experience. And how I came to terms with God comes into the story. And so I'm saying the words, God is good, and good is God. Somebody pushed, we had two bushes, bushy bushes on both sides of the couch. Somebody pushed one into the corner to get it out of the way to put two chairs there, but there was a halogen lamp in the corner. This is the honest to God truth. I'm saying God is good and good is God. The halogen lamp caught on fire and the bush caught on fire. It was real dusty and dirty, and you know when they're dusty and dirty, it really goes up fast. And this guy jumps up and he screams, "Oh, S-H-I-T," and he runs out. And I'm oblivious to him demanding a burning bush. All I know is my house is on fire and I'm freaking out. And so the soldiers got into action. They got the fire out. They took the bush out. And they brought band in to blow out the smoke and we all sat down. And it wasn't until my butt hit the seat that I got it. You know, I just remember thinking, oh my God, that man demanded a burning bush. He got the bush. And the whole room felt that experience. You could just feel the energy go around the whole room to all 30 soldiers. And those soldiers, I don't know about the one named Lee, but the other soldiers were so transformed, they went back to the treatment center. The treatment center was so impressed. They asked if they would like me, like them to be bussed over to my house instead of my having to get all these people to go pick them up. And I said, that would be great. But I didn't know it would be a white prison bus like you see on the freeway. I lived on a little cul-de-sac, and all of a sudden I hear this noise. I looked out blind, and here's this big white prison bus, and it's going all the way down the street, circles the cul-de-sac so nobody misses it, comes up, stops in front of my house. These guys are not in uniform, so some of them, you know, the cracks in their butts are showing, you know. All these guys get off the bus and come into the house, and I'm just wondering, oh my God, what am I going to tell the neighbors? How am I going to deal with this? You know, and that bus, now they've got three little vans. I think they heard my talk or something. You know, three vans. But that bus came for 8 years. Not one neighbor ever asked me what goes on in my house. If that had been parking across the street from me, I would have gone over there and said, do I need to lock my doors and bar my windows? But nobody ever asked. But you could sure see them peering out into the blinds and the kids waiting around the cul-de-sac to see the big bus come. So, but I can't believe it. I've been doing this for over 20 years now. 20 years, I couldn't believe it until one of the top officials at the hospital said that I was doing it for decades, called it decades. And they're still coming, and I just am so thankful because all the crap I was going through with surgeries and my daughter and all those ups and downs and low spots, that was the highlight of my life. Having those soldiers there, they've let me take those soldiers to conventions. They've let me take the women soldiers to the ladybug retreat. And I sponsor some of those soldiers today. And I know some of you have heard about Airplane Anna's story. That's a great story, but I'm not going to share it because it takes too long. But some of the experiences I've had sponsoring people have been the greatest gifts. You're sharing their spiritual experience. Vivian, when she had her ladybug experience, we were in, you know, the cemetery. She was trying to make amends for her 9-year-old daughter dying. And I got to share that experience with her. You know, she was suicidal when we went there to make those amends. And I watched the light come on in her eyes, and I watched everything about her change, and I watched her go back to Hilton Head and start the most awesome movement of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and that's just the stuff that I get to experience because I'm willing to suit up and show up, and it has nothing to do with me. But it has everything to do with my staying sober and getting through trials and low spots and just never taking this program for granted. Never. I'm always grateful. Always grateful. So anyways, I got into my steps right away, 4 and 5. You know, doing that 4-step in columns. You know, I hear people, they do all the names, and then it's column. I mean, that's not how I read the book. I read the book. You do the names and the cause, and then you go to the other columns. That's how I do it. I have to do it that way because I'll write 100 names down, and by the time I go back for the cause, I can't remember why I'm resentful. You know, so that's my personal way. And I know Bill mentions several things. It doesn't matter how you do it as long as you do something. And so you have to do three inventories, one on resentment, one on fear, and one on sex. Some people are now adding another sheet saying harm's done to others with no resentment in connection. But I just have them do it under resentment, and I have them do, I'm resentful at myself. Then they can list all that stuff, and then go on to the other people that resentful at. And then there's fear inventory. What is your fear? Why do you have it? And, you know, it has the fear prayer. And I've just gotten a lot out of the fear inventory. And I frequently have to do another one. It's just the way I have to do things. And the sex inventory. And it's not who hurt you. If somebody hurt you, you put it under resentment. It's who did you hurt because of your sex conduct. And it goes far beyond people you sleep with. The person I hurt the most because of my sex conduct was my daughter. She was 14 years when I got sober. But I'm very ashamed of the kind of mother I was and the situations I left her in and the things that she saw that she shouldn't see. She is the one that I hurt the most because of my sex conduct. And I'm not proud of it, but it's just a fact. And then when they talk about, you know, it says relations, we put each relation to the test. It's not saying every sex experience, you know, because a lot of us have had a lot of one-night stands. A lot of one-night stands. So I just put them in one lump, all the one-night stands. So anyway, so that's the sex inventory. And I love the part, what could I have done instead? That is a tool for me, especially when I'm doing step 10. And I do my step 10 out of the big book on retirement, and I had to answer all those questions. And the biggest tool for me was, what could I have done better? I can't change my behavior unless I know what I can change it to. So I need to write it out and look at it from an entirely different way. So, and I'm one that believes in 6 and 7 because that's how Dr. Bob's people took me through 6 and 7 after doing the inventory, giving it away to the person I gave it away to. Then we had to list all my character defects. Whoever listened to my inventory had a list, and then I had my own list. And we put them together, and then said the 7-step prayer. Then afterwards, we went to the other side of the piece of paper and wrote down what we could do to help God remove the defect. You know, the 12 and 12, the one thing I do like in the 12 and 12 is step 6. Says God's not going to render you white as snow without your cooperation. And it says the man that repeatedly works on his other defects of character grows the image of his creator. Doesn't say gets rid of them, they go away, you get perfect. It just says repeatedly works on them. And as I said earlier, I filed that sign, you're not a failure unless you quit trying. But I know my defects of character are removed or transformed or inside out or whatever God's going to do with them in the direct proportion that they're interfering with my life. And that's because I pray for the willingness to address them. And sometimes I have to pray for a very long time. How much time do I have, Lee? Okay, thank you. Steps 8, my sponsor had me do step 8. In, so anyway, on this list, 6 and 7, I've got this list. Now I've got the other side, things I can do, like self-pity. I can do gratitude lists. A lot of things, you have to practice acceptance. And it's a lot of practice. But they had me fold that piece of paper in half, and you no longer look at the defects. You just look at the set of actions that you're going to start trying to take in your life. And somehow that just starts the removal of some of those defects. So you're not focused on the defects, you're just focused on this new set of actions you're going to take in your life. So on step 8, they had me do it in 3 columns. First column was short-term amends that I could do within 6 months, usually verbal. Second column was long-term amends, which is usually financial, and it took me 12 years to finish my list of amends because I had a lot of financial records. I stole a lot. And had a lot of bills, ran out on rent. I owed a landlord $1,000. I ran out on a dentist bill. I made a move to Colorado for 3 months and met my real dad. There was a lot of wreckage there that I did that I had to make amends for. But where was I going with that? Oh, in Colorado, a dentist fixed the tooth I had. And so when it came to making my amends, I was only there for 3 months when they kicked me out of Colorado. Making my amends, I tried really hard to get hold of that dentist because I was trying to pay the bill and I couldn't. So my sponsor had me go to a dentist in my area and give that dentist the amount of money I owed and tell him to apply it to the bill of someone who couldn't pay. I did not get away with, well, honey, if you could, you would. I didn't have a sponsor like that. The rent, my landlord was from another country, and he sold the building, and he moved back to that other country. And I tried really hard to find him, and I couldn't find him. So my sponsor had me give a monthly amount of money to a homeless shelter until I paid off $1,000. So everything that I had, we worked out ways and means of taking some kind of action to clean that crap out so I could let God in. The third column was we worked out ways and means of making some kind of restitution or whatever we needed to do to people we couldn't get hold of, like children that have died, like Vivian's child dying and her writing a letter and us going to the cemetery. J.C. Penney's, or J.C. Penney's money, and that's the last amends I ever made, and it was the least, it was so insignificant, but that penny didn't exist anymore, and I just kept putting it off, I heard Pat Yo's thing on finances. She's doing this, I hope I'm not telling on you, Pat. I know you're back there somewhere. She's doing all these workshops and talking and all that, but she had one man she hadn't made, it was the J.C. Penney's. And when she said that, I'm going, oh, crap. Because I'm speaking all over and giving workshops and everything. So what I did is if you go there in person, you don't have to give your name or nothing. What I did is I just sent them a check with all my information. If they wanted to take me to court, they could. But I gave them all my information, took care of that. I got a letter back thanking me, and they have a special chart of accounts of people making amends. So that just really got me, that they're all prepared for all these 12-step programs. Now they're getting all this money back. So it took me 12 years to finish my original list of amends and restitution. Steps 10, 11, and 12. I just can't say enough about them. I live by those steps. They are the maintenance steps. I religiously do a step 10 in writing because I did my fourth step in writing. And I used to do a balance sheet, my assets and liabilities for the day. And then I started doing On Retiring at Night as my step 10. And that was more useful for me than anything, especially the tool of what I've done instead. I started learning how I could change my behavior. And that's how I still tend to do it. I do gratitude lists. There's a lot of things I do to practice that step 10 and 11. I found a fabulous form of meditation. It's called Getting Into the Gap. I don't know if any of you have ever heard it. It's by Wayne Dyer. My husband won this book with a CD at a convention, and it sat on his nightstand for years. And one day I picked it up, and it was just so awesome. And what he does is he just has you use the first 10 words of the Lord's Prayer. And he has you picture the word R. In calligraphy and printing, you just picture and focus on R. And then you focus on Father. And then you come back to the gap in between R and Father, and you focus on the nothing. Only for a second, 2 seconds, whatever. There's nothing there. And then you do a mantra. And his mantra is awe, because almost all these religions, the sound of awe is in it instead of om. So you do a mantra afterwards. Then you go back to Father, focus on it, go back to who art in heaven. Each word. Come back to the gap and focus on the gap. And that's how I really learned to still my thoughts. And it started with just 1 second. And getting out of space between two words. And that was the way that I started learning how to meditate. Anyway, I'm sure with my story with you, and I'm going to close. And so I came to terms with the God I have in my life. I already told you about my daughter's kidnap. I had so much trouble with that sentence in the big book. Absolutely nothing of God's will happens by mistake. I had to pray about it daily because I really hurt a girl that I work with. She told me her tragedy was worse than my daughter's. And she said hers must be God's will because in the big book it says absolutely nothing of God's will happens by mistake. I went off on her like a crazy woman, started screaming at her that was written by the first 100 alcoholics. It's not in the first 164 pages of the big book. I took the big book, I slammed it down, I said it's not even in the first 2 editions of this book. And I made her cry. She had this big alligator tooth. This resentment is not only hurting me, now it's hurting another person. So I came to a place of really being willing to give it up. And I prayed daily for God to just help me with that sentence. And that's just our thing, help me with that sentence. And I was in a meeting with my sponsor, Polly, just a little meeting in Long Beach. She was sharing about that tape out by Clancy. Two? Okay, good. That tape called Clancy is Alcoholism, Disease of Perception. And right in that meeting when she said the words, disease of perception, I had the biggest spiritual encounter that I've ever had. I couldn't see anything in the room. It was like a white fog. I couldn't hear another word Polly said. I had an inner voice. It was loud. It was clear. And I said, Michael, you know what happens in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is part of God's will. What happens when you're working those 12 steps is part of God's will. The progression of all good is part of God's will. What happened in that car at that time, 9 years ago, was part of man's world. So right there, I was able to separate man's world from God's world. And I was able to come to terms with that sentence in the big book. And I can tell you today, absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. And it's God's world that got me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. 2 weeks after I had that experience, I was sitting at a restaurant with a bunch of drunks next to a man named Dr. Paul. I was at such a... He wrote that sentence in the big book. I was at such peace, I did not have to go off on him and tell him about my resentment. Because I knew at that point it didn't matter what he meant when he wrote it. It was matter what mattered was how I perceived it. Sometimes I have to work on my perception, so whatever that perception is, it can work in my life. That might not work for you, and that's okay. I believe God works for each one of us at our own level of understanding. I once heard, if you take 1 step towards God, God takes 10 steps towards you. And in this lifetime, as we know it, we will never reach God's level of understanding. But once we're on a spiritual path, God does not want to lose one of us. So he comes to each one of us, and he works for each one of us at our individual level of understanding. And that's why what works for me might not work for you. What works for you might not work for me. But the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is whatever you believe, it will work within the 12 steps. That man later became my spiritual advisor. He talked at lots of conventions, and I have to tell you what he said. He said when he wrote that, he was 8 years sober, crazy as hell. And he was not thinking of man's inhumanity to man. He said my spiritual experience was the best explanation he could think of as to why evil exists in this world. I'm so thankful. Pay attention to something I read in 12 and 12 under step 10. It said restraint of pen and time. I cannot tell you how many times I started to write him a letter and tell him exactly what I thought about him in that sentence. And if I had, I would have missed out on this gift because it came to get to my life. Thank you for allowing me to share.